On May 18th, the American Psychiatric Association published the fifth edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, known more commonly as the DSM-5. Since its original publication in 1952, the DSM has been generally regarded as the universal authority for the classification, diagnosis, and treatment of mental disorders. In his book, Cracked, The Unhappy Truth About Psychiatry, British psychological therapist James Davis questions the scientific validity of the DSM and argues that the psychiatric profession has put its own interests above its patients' well-being at times. It is published by Pegasus Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. James Davis to our show today. Hello.
Hello there, Leonard.
What did the American Psychiatric Association, the APA, hope to accomplish when it published its comprehensive guide to mental illness in 1952?
Well, it's an interesting question, actually.
Well, there would have been nothing like it before.
No, there hadn't. I mean, there was a definite need in the psychiatric community to bring a certain amount of order to chaos, if you like. The chaos of there being a number of different species of suffering which hadn't been actually categorized. So the project was founded on a desire to order the different species of suffering so that clinicians would be better equipped with respect to the process of diagnosis.
A person could go to a doctor and say, I'm experiencing this thing, and one doctor would come up with one diagnosis, another would come up with another. This was an attempt to say, okay, if you see a number of different symptoms, it's probably this thing rather than that thing.
It was an attempt to do that with DSM-1. The problem, of course, is that it didn't solve the problem. The problem is known as poor diagnostic reliability. So the likelihood that two psychiatrists, independent of each other, will reach the same diagnosis when seeing the same patient, the likelihood that that would happen was very, very low. And it remained low through the first two editions of the DSM.
Well, they gave it a rather imposing name, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And who wrote it?
Well, teams of people wrote it. The first two editions were mainly written by psychoanalysts. But the most important edition of all was actually DSM-3, which was published in 1980. And that team, it comprised 15 people, but there weren't any psychoanalysts on the committee. It was headed by a psychiatrist who's now generally regarded to be the most influential psychiatrist of the 20th century, a man called Dr. Robert Spitzer, who himself was indeed the chairperson of that particular manual.
And that manual was an attempt to redress all of the problems that people had seen in all the previous ones.
That's right. That's what the attempt was. It was to solve the main agenda here was to solve the problem of poor diagnostic reliability. But it turns out that DSM-3 actually didn't solve that problem. And then still today, diagnostic reliability is still remarkably low.
You're right that there are only a few mental disorders that have biological markers known as organic disorders. What can you tell us about those?
Right. Well, you know, you have the organic disorders like Huntington's disease, epilepsy, Alzheimer's, etc.
And they're thought of as mental disorders similar to schizophrenia or some of the things that I usually think of as being mental disorders?
Well, they're in the diagnostic and statistical manual. So, yes, they're considered to be neurological disorders, psychiatric neurological disorders. But the difference between those and the rest of the disorders in the manual is, as you've just stated, for this small collection of disorders, there are known biological causes, whereas for the vast majority, about 95% of the disorders in the DSM, there are no known biological causes.
And so, in effect, they are man-made.
Well, you could. This is one of the arguments I make in the book. I like to put it this way. The reason why we're so surprised to find out that there are no biological causes for most of the mental disorders is because we expect psychiatry to work much like the rest of modern mainstream medicine. So in modern mainstream medicine, a name will usually be only given to a disorder after its pathological roots have been discovered in the body, such as in the cells, the organs, the tissue, etc. But the surprising thing about psychiatry is that it actually works in completely the opposite way. So psychiatry first names a disorder before any pathological roots have been discovered in the body. So it can, that disorder can become part of our medical culture, even though there's no sort of biological evidence to support its inclusion.
Well, if there's no biological evidence, then why do we prescribe drugs to help people overcome these problems?
Well, in the book, I argue that we prescribe drugs and overprescribe medications right now because psychiatry has been heavily influenced over the last 30 to 40 years by the sort of pharmaceutical revolution, which in many respects has influenced psychiatry towards privileging these medications as the first line of treatment for most disorders.
Well, we have a great British writer, Graham Greene, saying that if he was so overwhelmed by depression that if he hadn't been given Thorazine, he would never have written any of his books.
Right, okay. Well, look, I hear this quite a lot, and I suppose what I say in response is let's just look at what the research shows us. So we now know from wide-scale meta-analyses, these are studies that gather together all of the clinical trials that have sought to answer a particular question. In this case, do antidepressants work any better than placebo pills? We know from these clinical trials, from these meta-analyses, that they actually do not work better than placebo pills for the majority of people taking them. That's about 85% of patients. So that's not to say they don't work. It's just to say they don't work any better than placebos.
So because the placebo, when you take it, you are assuming that this is going to help you. And so since these are mental disorders, you may very well be helped. But then there are the side effects. So don't people who find that they're experiencing side effects assume that they're taking the real drug rather than the placebo, which is just a sugar pill?
Right. That's a very good point. So people on the real drug do experience side effects, and that can account for one of the reasons why sometimes the antidepressants work better than the placebo.
So you're saying that the side effect is having a placebo effect?
Exactly, because if you've got the side effect, then you must be on the real drug. I mean, these placebo effects are remarkably powerful. There was a fascinating study, which is now regarded to be a classic in placebo studies, published in The Lancet some years ago. And what the researchers did was gather together about 50 medical students, and it gave all of these students two bags of pills. One bag contained blue pills and the other bag contained red pills. The researchers told the students that one of these sections of pills will be tranquilizers and the other will be stimulants. The students then took the pills over a period of time and reported back to the researchers which of the pills were what. And what they showed unanimously, the students concluded unanimously, was that the red pills were the stimulants and the blue pills were the tranquilizers. And the reason for this is because they said when they took, you know, the red pills, they felt energized and, you know, excited, etc. And when they took the blue pills, they felt sleepy and calm and so forth. The researchers then told the students that actually both of these pills were chemically exactly the same. Both of them were made of sugar.
So it was really the color. Red suggests that we energy, and blue suggests calm.
It's exactly. It's the cultural associations that we attach to the colors that influence the effect they had. And, you know, you can change effects by changing the size of the pill, whether or not the pill is in tablet or capsule form, whether or not the pill has a brand name on it. All of these things affect the placebo effect.
My guest is James Davis. His book, Cracked, The Unhappy Truth About Psychiatry, it is published by Pegasus Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How many mental disorders were listed in the first edition of the DSM?
The first edition listed around 106.
And homosexuality was one of them?
Homosexuality was one of them. It was included in the same category as paedophilia. And it remained in the DSM up until the 1970s. And it was removed in 1975, largely because of the gay rights movement lobbying the DSM to take it out. So there was a vote conducted in 1974 at the annual APA meeting where all the psychiatrists attending were asked, you know, should we keep it in or should we take it out? And the vote was actually quite close. About, it was around about 3,800 voted to keep homosexuality in, and about 5,400 voted to take it out. Because, if you like, the outers were in the majority, homosexuality ceased to be a mental disorder in 1975.
A couple of states have recently passed laws prohibiting homosexual reversal therapies. Are they based on the approach that was used before 1973?
I think they're not necessarily based on the approach. I think they may be... These therapies are trying to get people who are homosexual to no longer be homosexual. So the assumption here is that there's something wrong with homosexuality. Okay.
Well, wasn't that what psychiatry was saying when they listed it as a mental disorder?
Exactly, exactly.
And so, then you could vote. You could just have a bunch of people vote and suddenly it stops being a mental disorder.
Exactly, exactly. And that, you know, this illustrates this fact that you can vote a disorder out of existence does illustrate to us something, you know, very important indeed. The fact that actually most of these categories I argue in the book are not founded on solid scientific evidence.
So this is different than if you get a bunch of physicists together and you ask them to vote on whether black holes exist or not.
Right. Okay. Exactly. I had the fortune, the great fortune of interviewing some of the leading psychiatrists in the world today. Last year, for example, I interviewed Spitzer, as I mentioned earlier, and I asked him about, you know, the construction of DSM. And, you know, he freely admitted to me that science often played a very minor role in how this manual was put together. And I spoke to other members of his task force, and they said, you know, when we were trying to define the disorders, we had almost no research guiding us on how to define them. We had very little research guiding us on whether or not to include new disorders, et cetera, and so forth.
Was one of the I'm sorry, finish your thought.
Well, I mean, the point here is that what the committee relied upon mainly was consensus, reaching consensus among themselves as to how something should be defined, or whether or not something should be included. But the problem here, of course, is that consensus or agreement does not constitute scientific proof.
Now, did the experiments that David Rosenhan published in 1973 in the journal Science under the title On Being Sane in Insane Places, did that have an impact on Spitzer and the subsequent editions of the DSM?
Well, exactly, because that piece of research illustrated the problem I spoke of earlier, which was to do with poor diagnostic reliability. The fact that, you know, people get diagnosed with mental disorders who might not necessarily warrant those disorders. And Rosenhan's experiment really put the psychiatric establishment of the day under a great deal of pressure to reform the current diagnostic
system.
What
did he do?
Well, he and a group of academics presented themselves at different psychiatric hospitals up and down the country, and they were given one instruction. The instruction was this: to go to the person on duty and say, I'm hearing a word. The word was thud. Then they had to wait to see what happened. All of them were admitted into the respective psychiatric hospitals. All of them were diagnosed with schizophrenia and prescribed powerful antipsychotic drugs. Of course, based on the word thud. Now, of course, after a few days, these guys started to say, look, all right, we've had enough of this now. We want to get out, you know. So they said to the doctors, look, you know, I've actually been performing an experiment and, you know, and I've proven something now and I'd like to be let out. Thank you very much. And the doctors just read this as a symptom of their, you know, delusions and kept them in. And so many of them were kept in for a long time and a couple for a couple of months.
How did the psychiatric community react to the article?
Well, they were very upset and some were outraged. In fact, one leading psychiatric hospital said, all right, okay, do it again. Send us some more fakes and this time we will spot them. So they, after about, I think it was about a month or so, they proudly announced to the media that they'd actually found the discovered 41 fakes. And then Rosenhan reported to the media that actually he'd sent no one to the hospital at all. So, yes, it didn't turn out very well. But indeed, it was the case that this piece of research really initiated a lot of soul searching within psychiatry, which ultimately led to this DSM-3 I mentioned earlier.
And tell us about Robert Spitzer. Why was he chosen to do the DSM-3?
Well, the APA, you know, were really struggling to find somebody to chair DSM-3. But Spitzer, he'd worked minimally on DSM-2, and he actually put himself up for chairmanship of DSM-3, and he was, you know, quite intellectually active. He was a researcher, he was a psychiatrist, he was very keen to do the job, so eventually the APA, you know, accepted his proposal.
And what changes did he make for the DSM-3? Were there any new disorders that were introduced, others that were taken out?
Well, homosexuality was taken out. The existing disorders were all sort of redefined and reorganized, and he introduced a brand new 80 new disorders into the DSM.
Did the changes that were made in the DSM-3 improve the problem of diagnosis reliability?
No. Actually, in short, it didn't. And I think that's...
But that's the whole idea, isn't it?
That was the whole idea. It didn't solve that problem. In fact, it introduced a collection of new problems that weren't anticipated at the time.
Well, he created a checklist to help psychologists diagnose their patients. According to Spitzer's checklist, how many symptoms of a disorder would a patient need to have in order to be diagnosed?
Well, let's take depression, for example. So out of a suite of 9 symptoms that characterize depression, the patient would have to experience at least 5 of them for 2 weeks or longer to warrant the diagnosis of depression.
And how did they come up with the number 5? Couldn't it be 6 or 4?
Well,
4.5?
Well, exactly, yes. A psychiatrist called Daniel Carlat posed that very question to Spitzer a couple of years ago, and Spitzer said, well, 6 sounded like a bit too much and 4 sounded like a bit too few, and so we ended up on 5. So basically, in other words, it was quite an arbitrary line that was drawn by the committee, but it's had immense implications, of course.
Well, one of the new disorders was ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder. What impact did that have on the diagnosis rate of children who were deemed as being troubled?
Well, actually, ADHD was introduced to DSM-4 in 1994 under a team headed by someone called Dr. Alan Francis. He was chairperson of DSM-4. I interviewed him for the book, and he said that once ADHD was included, they actually unleashed a false psychiatric epidemic. Rates of ADHD quadrupled. Hundreds of thousands of children were being diagnosed with this condition that actually didn't warrant the diagnosis.
And you write about a study conducted in Canada on children who'd been diagnosed with ADHD.
Yeah, so, I mean, this was really Francis's point, that lots of normal and natural childhood behaviors were being wrongly misread by doctors as indicating ADHD. And this particular study, published in 2011, looked at about 1 million Canadian school children. And what it discovered was that the younger a child is in the class, the more likely they are to be diagnosed with ADHD. So, for example, the youngest boys in the class were 30% more likely to be diagnosed than the oldest boys, and the youngest girls were 70% more likely to be diagnosed than the oldest girls. And what the authors concluded here is that a child's relative immaturity in the classroom was actually being wrongly misread as indicating ADHD.
My guest is James Davies, Davies. His book, Cracked, The Unhappy Truth About Psychiatry, is published by Pegasus. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with psychological therapist James Davies, who has written other books, The Importance of Suffering, also The Making of Psychotherapists. His most recent is Cracked, The Unhappy Truth About Psychiatry. It's published by Pegasus Books. So as a practicing therapist in England, do you consult the DSM?
No, I actually don't. I'm aware of the diagnostic categories, and many of my colleagues do. But personally, I don't. Personally, as a clinician, I don't find the categories particularly useful.
Are there national styles? Would psychiatry be practiced a little differently in the United States than in England or in France or Germany?
Oh, certainly. So schizophrenia...
I don't even want to mention Russia.
Right. Yeah, sure. So, you know, every country has its particular, you know, diagnostic legacy. I think in the United States, you're more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than you are in Britain. You're less likely to be diagnosed with depression in somewhere like Japan than you are in Britain, et cetera, and so forth. Because, these are different cultural worlds who read and respond to suffering in different ways.
So would somebody who is diagnosed as schizophrenic in this country and not diagnosed with it in Britain be healthier in England than he or she is in the United States?
Well,
is schizophrenia pretty clear in many cases?
Well, this is going back to the problem of diagnostic reliability. You know, what one psychiatrist will read as indicating a particular disorder, another won't. I mean, think of ADHD as an example. Picture the following scene. Two psychiatrists in a room with a child. Now, if one psychiatrist reads that child's behavior as indicating ADHD, while the other psychiatrist reads that same child's behavior as indicating that they're simply naughty, we have no way of knowing, objectively speaking, which of the two psychiatrists is correct. And there's a clear reason for this. The reason goes like this. There are no biological tests that can be undertaken to verify any psychiatric diagnosis. There are no blood tests, urine samples, saliva samples that can be conducted, etc., to verify diagnosis. So, you know, it leaves, you know, subjectivity to enter the equation and have its say.
But in the case of schizophrenia, we're talking about people who have delusions, hear voices, lose contact with reality, aren't we? Isn't that pretty clear?
Well, according to the diagnostic manual, all of those symptoms point to the existence of a disorder called schizophrenia. Okay, I'm not denying that those experiences are real and are very painful, but at other periods in history, those very same characteristics would have been understood, responded to, and managed somewhat differently than they are today. And the question is for us, is the current way in which we are understanding, managing, and responding to different species of suffering getting the best deal for patients?
And you write that the rate of people diagnosed with mental disorders has steadily been climbing over the past few decades. Is that because people are getting sicker or because we're starting to see illnesses where we didn't see them before?
Well, I would veer more towards the latter interpretation. So apparently one in four of us now suffers from a mental disorder in any given year. And I would say these figures are so startlingly high because psychiatry through the DSM has simply renamed more and more of our natural and normal, albeit painful, experiences as indicating psychiatric conditions.
Well, let's take a situation like autism, where 20 or 30 years ago it would be one in, I'm coming up with a number, 10,000 people might be diagnosed as autistic. And now we're in the 170 or 180, one in 180 range. People argue over whether there's an epidemic or whether we're just diagnosing it better or perhaps we're over-diagnosing it.
Well, I think there's, truth to all of those interpretations. I mean, one of the problems is that with many of the disorders, we're lowering the threshold for what constitutes warranting that diagnosis. Okay, now if you do that, what you end up doing is creating a scenario in which more and more people can potentially be diagnosed with the particular condition. Now, autism, is slightly different. I mean, autism, we know, we understand the neurobiology of autism better than most disorders. Autism is real. It needs to be managed. And I wouldn't deny the fact that people are suffering from this very real condition. The question is, of course, is whether or not all people who are being diagnosed warrant those diagnoses.
You mentioned that in 1994, the fourth edition of the DSM was published, this time headed by Dr. Alan Francis. What changes did he make?
Well, he actually only introduced eight brand new mental disorders, as it were, into the main body of the text. However, what he did do is subdivide many of the existing disorders that were we're in DSM-3, and he also included into the appendix about 30 brand new disorders. Now, all of these subdivisions and appendix inclusions were disorders with which patients could be diagnosed. So, in effect, he expanded the DSM from around 280 to around 370 disorders.
And he and his team hoped to stabilize arbitrary decisions by breaking these, coming up with all these subdivisions?
Well, yeah, I mean, I asked Alan Francis, why didn't he remove some of the disorders that were included under Spitzer, largely because many of these disorders didn't have solid scientific backing behind them. And frankly, many of them were eccentric. There were things like caffeine-related disorders, female orgasmic disorder, transsexualism, stammering, stuttering, oppositional defiant disorder. Not only were these somewhat eccentric disorders, but at the same time, they didn't have the research. I asked him, why didn't he simply get rid of them? His answer was that he preferred to stabilize the system than to introduce new problems by removing disorders randomly.
So caffeine-related disorder remained in the DSM.
And it's still there today.
I'm feeling guilty. I just drank another cup of coffee. Then this May, the APA published the DSM-5. What changes were made in the latest edition? Does this look any better than the previous ones?
Well,
to you, anyway.
To me, absolutely not. I think the DSM-5 is just compounding the problem. It's expanding the definition of mental illness to include more and more of what we would customarily regard as normal. And many, you know, very important and respected organizations have come forward to lobby against DSM-5, the British Psychological Association, for example, the Danish Psychological Association, even the director of the National Institute for Mental Health here in the United States has said at some point we're going to have to move away from this system.
Well, some people have suspected that the pharmaceutical industry has played a role in how the latest one was worked out.
Look, let me give you some figures here. Psychiatrists receive more money from the pharmaceutical industry than doctors in any other medical speciality. Okay, ProPublica, a respected watchdog charity, published only a few months ago a piece showing the following, that half of the highest payments made to medicine from the pharmaceutical industry were made to doctors from a single speciality, and that was psychiatry. So let me just illustrate that by now turning to the DSM. DSM-4, 88% of the people who were responsible for the categories for which drugs are the first line of treatment, these are the mood disorders, the anxiety disorders, the sleeping disorders, etc., 88% of those had financial ties to the industry. When we moved to DSM-5, out of the 29 people who put that manual together, a full 21 have had strong financial ties to the industry, including the chair and the vice chair. Now, I'm not suggesting there's a conspiracy going on here, okay? I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting these guys are all sitting down in a room and working out ways in which they can create more disorders so more people can be medicated.
Well, I was once told by a doctor that if you're a surgeon, your solution is to cut. And if you are a if you prescribe drugs, then that's your solution to the problem.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also this sort of financial influence has biased psychiatry towards prescribing these medications, because we know from research that doctors who receive money from the industry are more likely to be biased in their clinical activities and beliefs towards these medications than doctors who don't.
A listener left this comment on our show page. There were promising studies that sought to develop a protocol that favored both molecules and talk therapies together. Now it seems that DSM-5 is merely designed as a code guide for managed care and meds, completely walking away from emotional and behavioral analysis. Patients are being diagnosed and prescribed without any measured analysis, often by GPs. Aside from big pharma lobbying, what went wrong?
Right. Well, what went wrong? It's the million-dollar question, actually. And in my view, I think psychiatry was seduced. It was seduced in a particular direction. towards favoring the biomedical approach.
Well, don't most people think that mental disorders are about chemical imbalances and that medications are the best way to redress that problem?
Most people do think that. However,
it's not true?
Absolutely. The research does not support the chemical imbalance theory. The chemical imbalance theory was advanced by Joseph Schildkraut in 1967 as a theory. If you read his original paper, he proposes it as a theory, and he admits there's no research at the moment that confirms it. Ever since that paper was published, there has not materialized a single piece of convincing evidence justifying the chemical imbalance theory. So the reason why I would argue it's become so widespread is because the pharmaceutical industry actually saw this as an opportunity, as a way of legitimating the manufacturing and dispensing of its medications. Because presumably if these medications were correcting a biological imbalance, then of course it was legitimate to take them. So pharmaceutical marketing has played an enormous role in putting this particular theory on the map.
So when people take an antidepressant when they're feeling stressed, you're saying that it has no impact, that or that it's just simply having a placebo effect?
For about 85% of patients, it's a placebo effect. Okay. So there are a small minority of patients for whom they work better than placebos. And these are the most severely distressed or depressed patients. But for the vast majority of people taking them, no.
Have the changes made in the DSM-5 caused more people to be diagnosed with mental disorders? Actually, is it too soon to tell? We're talking about something that came out only a few months ago.
Well, exactly. It's certainly too soon to tell. But if the historical record is anything to go by, I think we're in a position to confidently predict that DSM-5 is certainly not going to decrease the number of people being diagnosed with these disorders.
Does the APA financially benefit from publishing new editions of the DSM?
Well, yes, it does. Most of its revenue is attained via the publication of DSM, and that was actually one of the arguments against DSM-5. There was no need for a new manual, many people argued, and the only reason why DSM-5 was actually put together was because if there's a new edition of the DSM, then the old edition is no longer fit for purpose and everybody has to go out and buy the new edition.
It's like a new smartphone.
Right.
So what would you do? What changes do you feel need to be made within the psychiatric community to positively affect people's health? Don't we need some kind of diagnostic manual?
Right. I think, you know, we do need some sort of category system to orient clinicians. But I think we need a system that's greatly scaled down from the one we currently have. I mean, the World Health Organization actually has a small manual. It contains about 10 disorders in it, and it works relatively well. So I think, you know, we do need some sort of typology. But what we have right now has got somewhat out of hand.
James Davis' latest book is called Cracked, The Unhappy Truth About Psychiatry. Has this been published in England?
It has, yes.
And now published in the United States by Pegasus Books. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me.